Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson, and I'm joined by co-host Terry Robinson. A map and compass will get you through the wilderness, but when you're a storyteller trying to get through the middle umbra, what do you need? The player characters will need adrenaline, sharp wits, and some granola bars, but you need more. Three books for the game Werewolf the Apocalypse describe what's in the middle umbra, what borders it, and how to move around. Today, Terry and I talk cosmology of the umbra with a focus on the middle umbra. We will draw on material from those three books, which are all editions of Umbra the Velvet Shadow. First, Terry, are there any announcements for us?
I don't have any announcements for us. Should I make up something? Yes, after many long months and just trying to get, I have the one-dot wonders that we give to our Oracle supporters are currently in production. I have seen a preview of them. They look very nice, and it is going to be a nice little Mage the Ascension-themed dice bag. So for anyone who supports us at that level, thank you so much. And if we have any leftovers, we will make them available to anyone else. So thank you, executive producers, for your support.
Makes me wish I was an executive producer. That sounds kind of cool.
I'm going to say I made one for you.
I've got three different D10 sets from Chessex, and they're still in their original like plastic case things because I don't have dice bags for them, but I plan to use them for Mage. Well, we start off with getting around in the middle umbra. There are six ways werewolves travel in the middle umbra: moon bridges, moon paths, erits, spirit gates, climbing the weaver's web, and just walking. Let's look at these and see which might help mages. Moon bridges are mentioned often in werewolf books. They are magical, silvery roads that rise up into the air. They connect two places on Earth, but in between, the road passes through the middle umbra. At the highest point, they pass through the Aetherian reaches. Moon bridges usually connect two werewolf cairns and are guarded by spirits in addition to werewolves. It is very hard for mages to use moon bridges, and even if they do, they wind up in the middle of a crowd of grumpy werewolves. Mages no doubt see moon bridges when they visit the Aetherian reaches, but I'd say they warn each other to stay off. Moon paths are silvery pathways that connect two places in the middle umbra. Werewolves use them, but believe they belong to Luna, the Celestine of the moon. If a mage meets a werewolf on a moon path, the creature will probably let the mage pass. I'd say the werewolf will assume the mage is either the kinfolk of a werecreature or under Luna's protection. Moon paths are simple enough to use when the moon is full. The less moon is showing, the harder the path is to make out. On moonless nights, the moon paths disappear. If you want to move things along, just let the players use the moon path. If you want to emphasize the hazards of the spirit world, make them use their spheres, enigma skill, or cosmology. Less than five successes, give them an encounter. Some spirit, a mage, or werecreature that will challenge or distract them. The third method of travel is erits. Erit is a game term for a spirit path. When many spirits travel the same route or a powerful spirit passes, a faint spirit trail can be detected. Appearances vary. It can be a spectral line through the air, a glowing path on the ground, unexpected leaves on the ground, anything you can think of that suggests a trail to follow. Werewolves are half-spirit themselves, so they can sense erits. Mages with a high rating in the spirit sphere may see them without a roll. Those who think to look for them may use their cosmology, spirit lore, or spheres to spot one. Correspondence plus spirit, perhaps only possible if they possess enough cosmology. Storytellers should determine their own guidelines to portray the middle umbra the way they want in their own games. I think erits should be easier to find and use in the high umbra for mages. The fourth method is spirit gates. These are naturally occurring gates that instantly connect two places in the umbra. Anchor heads that connect the near and deep umbra are one example of a spirit gate. Some realms have spirit gates leading to other realms inside the middle umbra. The books tell us every spirit gate is guarded, but that doesn't have to be the case in your games. I would have a puzzle that must be solved to use the gate in the place of a guardian for some of them. I would also say mages know of more spirit gates than werewolves do, but then I'm a little biased towards mages to begin with. Spirit gates can help you move your players around quickly, so you don't have to worry about travel every time. The fifth method of travel is the weaver's webs. The weaver, the embodiment of stasis to werewolves, is trying to encase the middle umbra in its pattern web. Werewolves can climb the web to reach destinations. They have to make their roles and deal with servants of the weaver that may be hostile. The book portrays this method as useful for reaching a variety of places. Can mages climb it? The pattern web is optional for mage storytellers. If you want to emphasize how the modern world is getting limited by increasing technology or limited technical thinking, you could use the pattern web in your games. Rather than always a spider web, I would say it appears as something appropriate to the setting. Frameworks of stone, steel scaffolding, plastic wires, whatever works. Rather than a convenient method of general travel, I would say climbing the pattern web always leads to a place related to the notion of stasis, autochthonia or dystopia, but not the radiance. The books suggest meeting stasis spirits to complicate the climb. I think that's appropriate. However, don't always make it a fight. Mages might reach a small platform in the steel scaffolding where they encounter a spectral construction site foreman or shadowy figure with a badge and clipboard. The players may have to explain how they belong there or prove they have knowledge of the pattern web. The sixth method is just walking. Players don't need a defined path before they set off. In fact, I would say cosmology helps mages detect which paths are false or traps. Sometimes striking out on one's own is the best method. So Terry, what do you think of getting around the middle umbra?
I like the fact that since werewolves don't have sphere magic, they have to give them a bunch of ways to do it. Now, most of these exist in some way in Mage already, but there's another thing that they mentioned that I think are neat, which is to say fetishes, talons, spirit objects, and other boons and blessings that allow you to get around. So two of the ones that they mention are owl wings, which is, hey, if owl is your totem, or in Mage, what I would just refer to as a spirit patron, you can fly from place to place. So I like the idea of your characters temporarily having access to this as a rapid way to move around. Another idea that we get is the idea of spirit trains. These are kind of tied to Aerts. And I like the idea that mages would be following a spirit and they get to see how a spirit views moving around in the umbra. Like, you want to show that something is strange and weird and different. Show what a spirit thinks the most direct path is. And you're like, oh yeah, you want to go here to here? Well, we're going to go, we have to go through the ocean, through the Arcadian Gateway. There's a weird hole in the back of the cyber realm that we're going to travel through. And then through the Radiance briefly, we want to stop to get a snack. And then we're going to continue on and we're going to take you to the Legendary Realm because that's the most obvious way to do it. And your characters are like, oh. And you have various roles and encounters on there, and you try and make it so that if something terrible happens, they just wind up in a weird place, and they're like, well, so that happened. I also like the fact that things like the moon paths and the moon bridges are kind of temporarily usable. So moon bridges require to be open at each side via a particular rite, and oh man, did cell phones probably make that easier? Like, hey, you gonna open your end? Yeah, I'm gonna open my end. Just give me about 45 minutes. Sandra's coming back. We wanted to get sandwiches first. As opposed to being like, today is the day where we do the ritual. And you're like, wait, did we adjust for daylight savings time? So drat stupid railroads or something like that pops up. The idea that moon paths exist, but only at night and vary by the phase of the moon. I think that's cool that the mages are like, yeah, there's a path here to get from here to here. It only exists in this particular period of time. So now suddenly it's like, well, I guess you have to do your mission in under 9 days before the phase of the moon kind of changes. I also appreciate that in Werewolf, we get information on what the sensory experience feels like, in that it says that passing over a moon bridge feels like you're running on a glass track, that sensory information gets muddled, especially as you approach the Aetherian reaches and so on. In general, they won't go directly to where you need to go, but will get you near. And the notion of near as the storyteller is entirely up to you. So I think these are neat. I like the fact that there are varied ways of doing it. The encounter system that Adam mentioned, I think, is a really cool way of doing it. You roll for successes. Any fewer than that, there are certain encounters or detriments. Another one that I've thought of is you have to get your pool of successes. Everyone rolls the appropriate thing. And for each success less to it, costs you 2 points of quintessence, a health level, 2 points of willpower, something like that. Basically a way of saying, yeah, you can get from here to there. We're going to do it quickly. But this is going to represent how taxing the journey was. And this is a system that can be generalized to the rest of the Umbra with no difficulty, in my opinion. So yeah, I thought it was fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. A sort of resource management angle to travel through the Umbra. If you need to go farther, you need to manage your resources. But since those resources are things that are already on your character sheet and you're already looking for, it doesn't feel like a burden to the players. So that is very cool. I like that. Well, before I launch into Cosmology of the Umbra, all three Umbra books for Werewolf the Apocalypse emphasize using props and cues during scenes in the Umbra to help your players understand they aren't in Kansas anymore. Candles, mood music, and other devices may sound like cheap tricks, but when used properly, I think they can really help players see the Umbra as a different environment than the Earth they left. Even just taping up a poster or draping a colored sheet over a chair near the storyteller can help signal to your players. This advice was written before so many games moved online. For online games, I can't give you advice because props and cues will depend on the software or sites you are using for your online game. The penumbra is the spiritual reflection of Earth. When characters step sideways, the penumbra will mostly resemble the spot on Earth they left. Two inconsistencies showed up in these books, for me anyways. People don't show up in the penumbra, yet werewolves can see, is it pronounced chimeras? A chimera occurs when a regular human is sleeping and having dreams. If werewolves can't see people, how do they see the chimeras people generate? Possibly a nitpick, but it just came up in my mind as I was reading. Also, a place shows its true nature in the penumbra, yet it takes time for the spiritual reflection to catch up with the earthly reality. A place in the penumbra could look awful, but people stopped doing awful things there months or even years ago. How does anyone know if the spiritual reflection is accurate or up to date with the earthly reality? This might be a real problem in your games. Do players learn to ignore the penumbral reflection of a place, or does the storyteller need to develop a way for the players to tell how accurate the penumbral reflection is? I use one penumbra for the high and middle umbra together. I would say let players get wrong impressions sometimes. When they discover the reflection in the umbra isn't always right, their mentor or research can point them towards a rote. Something like Time 2, Spirit 2, and Correspondence 1. The spheres involved are up to the storyteller, of course. If you want to make it harder, require them to spend quintessence for this. Mages of all people should understand looking past surface appearances. Well, Terry, did you have any thoughts on the penumbra before we move on?
I think the penumbra is interesting because for werewolf, it raises to me the Vidare question. Why don't they see it? Do they have their idealized view of everything? Is that like the Vidare Garum or the Vidare Gaium? Are they seeing the true penumbra and mages are just bringing their own opinions in it? And this also answers the question of one of the problems in Mage is Mage took the idea of glens, blights, and hellholes. That there are these special areas that are dominated by one of the triadic forces or by Taint or by Gaia or something like that. Did the Vidare cast over that? So, like, if I'm in the Vidare Mortem and I see a glade, is it a dead glade or is it just a glade? Glen?
I think it might be Glen.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry. Does that blow through it? And I like the idea that those parts are like the one thing that would kind of pierce through all of it. Werewolf does provide the idea that the penumbra and the material world, the mundane world, are in much closer communication, that if you keep breaking a penumbral door, eventually the material door will fall through. I would have loved a system for that because I think it would be really cool that your characters need to stage that break-in and one character can step sideways, but not all of them. So you have this person who is going through and almost Home Alone-like, weakening this stair, breaking this door, making sure that this window is unlatched to just make it so when you finally do the bank robbery or you steal the corporate documents or you bust into the Nefandus' house or whatever, you have a few things kind of working in your favor. And you can just represent that mechanically with reductions in difficulty or something. But I think something a little bit more specific could be useful. I also appreciate that in Werewolf, they talk about the sensory experience of stepping sideways the first time. They refer to it as the second breath, and it is the feeling of being complete. And I think that's something that we can take in Mage. The first time a Hermetic or Solificato steps into the Vulgate, they think truly clearly for the first time. The first time your shamanic character steps into the Middle Umbra, they finally feel at touch with this power that they've been trying to do their entire life. The first time your religious character steps into the spire of the Izata or the spire of the Hanged Man or the spire of the Man Jesus, they feel this radiance and warmth that they've never experienced before. And to me, that explains the idea in 1E and 2E that that's why the masters are all out there. Not only because magic is easier, but because these other places just feel right. And that represents a stumbling block on the pathway to ascension, potentially, as you're like, well, that's not actually where these things are going to happen. The other thing that I like is, at least in the 2014 Umbra book, it gives a list of locations where Garu of particular types do their first stepping sideways. And I really like that in Mage, to be like, hey, this is going to be weird and alien and difficult. This is where we're going to do this for the first time. And each group or each tradition has a location where they do it, probably near a node because the gauntlet is low. But in the same way that the Agama Sojourn for the Euthanatoi is so ritualized, I think it can be really powerful in a Mage game to have that first stepping sideways event, that first time that you astrally project, being done in a particular set and setting to kind of create this paradigmic effect that you want to have. I like the idea of bringing those dreams into the penumbra and then asking the question, how is this different than the Maya? How is this different than the dream realm? Is this a false reflection of it? Is this merely the idea of dream? Or alternatively, that's a shortcut. I just like having kind of weird things that people can play with. The web, I like that it allows you to kind of use the weaver against itself. You have this force of stasis, you have the webs, like, oh, you're trying to keep everything in space. Well, I'm literally using this to move from place to place. I kind of like that. So yeah, the one thing Werewolf does is it gives a bunch more penumbra locations. If you've kind of been saying, okay, the penumbra, I kind of get it, but I just need more examples and more cool stuff that's in there, any of the Umbra books are going to do great. I think the 2014 book probably does the best example of adding those weird other places, like wilding places, the periphery of thought, the edge of darkness. And if we were doing this as a walkthrough, we go into those in more detail, but we have so much book to get through.
Yeah, the centerpiece of these three books is what werewolves call the near realms. Werewolves talk about 13 near realms, but Malpheus, the dangerous realm of the worm, is also in the Middle Umbra, as well as the tribal homelands. Each werewolf tribe has a tribal homeland realm. Mages don't count the number of realms in the Middle Umbra, but Book of Worlds offers 7. Page 189 of that book tells us the Mythic Worlds is an overlap of the tribal homelands and Battleground. Actually, the Mythic Worlds is what werewolves call the Legendary Realm. I think the Mythic Worlds belong in the High Umbra, but I can see Gaia building a mini Mythic Worlds and putting it in the Middle Umbra for werewolves to more easily reach. I would link the two in my games. The other error is the Wasteland is not really an overlap of Atrocity Realm and Scar. It's just the Atrocity Realm. Book of Worlds tells us the 7 realms they list are the only ones mages should be able to visit. I disagree. I think Erebus, the realm of Werewolf Purgatory, Wolfhome, the realm of Werewolf Attitude Adjustment, and the Tribal Homelands should be invisible to mages. The others should be findable. I want to offer my thoughts on the remaining realms. It's a lot to cover, but I don't know when I'll revisit this material. As I said before, the first two Umbra Velvet Shadow books give you more detail about these realms than Book of Worlds, so they are worth your time. What mages call the chasm, werewolves call the abyss. I think Think of an immense canyon that isn't beautiful, it's terrifying. It seems to be sucking the life out of the whole Umbra as you stand there watching it. This is a realm that draws people in so mages can end up there accidentally. Werewolves know of 3 paths down into the canyon. Mages know of 5. All write-ups of this realm leave the reader wondering, what is its real nature? Is it Gaia's fear of death? This would naturally link with people's fear of death. Is it obsessing over things that are lost? Is it a shadow cast by the Shenti of entropy? The nature of the realm matters because that knowledge helps players escape. It's not a place you want to hang around for very long. If it's a fear of death, players who make their willpower saves may have no obstacles finding their way out. Seeing that Mother Earth fears death makes the idea of Gaia as a person seem a little more believable. If it's fixation on things that are lost, players who avoid looking for goodies in the canyon are better able to leave. If it's a manifestation of entropy, then looking for goodies in the caves isn't dangerous and can provide some good stuff. Nightmaster is mentioned very vaguely in Book of Worlds. He's a shadowy figure who may attack visitors to the chasm. The Umbra books make it clear it's a werewolf who went bad. There are stats that you can use. The 2001 book on page 137 has stones called Heart of Midnight or Hearts of Midnight. It nullifies magic used against the possessor, but also the possessor's own magic. I would like to use these stones in my games. If acolytes are planning mischief against their mage bosses, they're going to want the heart, liver, and spleen of Midnight. The Aetherian Reaches is a realm that, in a way, is the sky above the Middle Umbra, at least in places. The Stargazer tribe of werewolves have an orrery there. Think of an observatory, but instead of astronomers, you have wolfmen who like to meditate. The first 2 Umbra books make this place sound interesting to me. There is an immense physical model of the universe that moves to stay in sync with the actual universe. It is built from the perspective of someone looking at the universe from the Middle Umbra. Page 31 of the first Umbra book describes the model as like walking through an M.C. Escher drawing. There are some rolls you can make to keep your balance and keep moving through it. Page 43 of the second Umbra book tells us significant celestial bodies in the model are as large as a living room, and mages can sit inside and view the model from a unique point. This will give insights you can use to push your story forward or justify a player spending experience points on cosmology skill. The orrery is on the lowest level of this realm, where the clouds form a kind of landscape. Spirits of birds, other flying creatures, air and storm elementals make homes here. Mages can visit them for help. I would have no problem placing Aelida, Lady of Feathers, here. She's an Umbrid mentioned in several mage books associated with air and birds. Moonsilver and Wildstones can be found here, useful to mages. The 2001 book lists the 9 planetary incarna. A Rage Across the Heavens goes into detail, but here we get names and brief descriptions. Whether or not they are manifestations of human beliefs of the celestial bodies that live in the near Umbra, or actual spirits who live in the deep Umbra and have great power, is up to storytellers. If they're in the near Umbra, technomages are right to ignore them. They can only share cultural beliefs from Earth. If they maintain fortresses in the deep Umbra, the dream speakers are right, and they can provide much knowledge and assistance to those who start the journey in the Aetherian Reaches and reach them. High Brazil is a realm called Arcadia Gateway by the werewolves. It is a realm of fickle fairies, and the write-ups in these 3 books shift around to prove it. In 1993, it was a realm created by the Fae in the Middle Umbra to guard the door to Arcadia. We can assume Arcadia is the part of the dream zone where the Fae have established themselves. Fairies lived in High Brazil. In 2001, the realm formed from humans encountering and talking about the Fae. As a result, the residents are spirits that look like fairies but are not actually fairies. But why is it in the Middle Umbra when it ought to be in the High Umbra? I think that's a question we're not supposed to ask. In the 2014 book, the realm formed as a result of the Fae coming to Earth centuries ago or leaving the Earth more recently. In 1993, the Seelie lived on one edge of the realm where it was always summer, the Unseelie on the opposite edge where it was always winter. The Seelie guarded the gate to Arcadia while the Unseelie tried to wrest it away from them. In 2001, the Lord of the Seelie was gone, and the Unseelie, along with cold weather, were taking over. In 2014, the Lord of the Seelie disappeared not long ago and might turn up again. After reading the 1993 write-up, this realm appeals to me. It is a way to add some fairy material to your game without reading thick changeling books or complicating your depictions of Earth. The fairies know where the ancient fae places of power are on Earth and what they may hold today, so there's a reason to consult them. It is an alternate route to the Dream Zone if you negotiate with the Seelie Lord. The 1993 book gave me more material to flesh out the realm for my games. I felt like the later two Umbra books for Werewolf, they were a bit less appealing to me, a little bit less specific information, and also they had a sort of a apocalyptic mood to them, like the end is coming and things are awful, and so it was a little bit less appealing to me, but I will admit they were more dramatic, and that may appeal to you. The Wasteland is a realm that werewolves call the Atrocity Realm. I think Book of Worlds did a very good job adapting this to non-werewolf visitors. The three Umbra books describe how werewolves travel here to fight bane spirits and learn about past crimes. The 2001 book adds a worm fortress that werewolves want to attack. The 2014 book adds the Atrocity Library, where information can be gained on horrendous crimes committed on Earth, but only by people who have committed such crimes themselves. Some moral complications there if you try to do any research. Other than some suggested skill checks to handle scenes here, I don't get much out of the Umbra books. I think the Book of Worlds handles this realm nicely. Battleground is a realm where countless battles play out from every era of history, even some that could not have happened, like, say, Vietnam War, American soldiers fighting warriors from antiquity. Not a very fair fight, but it could happen. The central idea here is Gaia remembers the battles people fight on her soil. That means Gaia cares deeply for her human residents. Once a battle begins, it may play out differently than it did on Earth, so mages can gain historical insights, but must not trust them too much. The 2001 book adds battles between forces of the Triat spirits. Mages can learn more about Middle Umbra spirits by watching these battles. Battleground fits well with the theme of fierce combat emphasized in Werewolf the Apocalypse. I don't think it fits quite as well for Mage, but you can take your players there if you like. So Terry, any thoughts on these five Umbral realms?
Yeah, so Adam and I already talked about the realms that were in Book of Worlds. We talked about Book of Worlds. So the thing I look to when I read through this is what happens if we take the werewolf interpretation and use it in our mage game? What does that give us? So I like the Abyss as an idea of this being a stronghold of the Kalashaw, the kind of the raving madness portion of the Nafandi, and this being that place of where they feel that this is the easiest place to reach some of the Klippoth. And this kind of being a place that shows the fact that kind of an excess of quiet in any direction always leads to this weird kind of madness. Someone with high denial, someone with high morbidity, someone with high madness, all being pulled towards the Abyss. And the Abyss having a static entropic and kind of dynamic show of it. So you have the rock wall, which shows stasis. You have the void, which shows entropy. And then you have the howling wind that shows dynamism. And this is kind of where those forces are brought together. Maybe this is also a place of healing that a character who goes from there and navigates the path of iron or the path of gold or the path of silver is able to kind of come back from having had a derangement or something. I always try and indicate try and figure out a positive use for each location and not just a, oh no, you were blown off course on the way. I guess you're going to have to deal with this encounter that you had no way of seeing coming that I had prepared last week. That's just my storyteller and table style. I like that it contains spirits of forgotten concepts. So for mages that don't have access to the low Umbra, the Abyss could also kind of represent kind of this vast garbage wasteland of discarded ideas, concepts, and spirits. This is where that kind of just staring into the void provides enough quintessence for spirits of abandoned concepts to still be able to subsist. So there's this weird lost colony of abandoned ideas there. The Aetherian Reaches, I like because moving about is wildly creative. You can have 200 trained pigeons. You can use a catapult. You can use a rocket ship. You can use a hovercraft. You can use a gyrocopter. You can pray your way there. All of them work. Like, it's the werewolf version of everything works. And I think that's a lot of fun. The other cool thing that's here is all of a number of planetary incarnae have their courts here. So you have your character that's used to the High Umber being like, I know how to navigate the courts in the Spire. Okay, I'm not a noob. And then they find themselves here and they're like, oh, you want to talk with Apollo, exemplar of Helios. You literally have to work your way through this wall of fire elementals. And they'd be like, nah, crap, didn't bring my flame retardant pants. So I like that this gives another way to reach those courts and to get another view of how the umbral hierarchies work. What do the middle umbral courts think about the high umbral courts? Are they in communication? The fact that this area is rich with anchor heads, I think, is great for crossover because they're relatively close by. It's a thing where you do a quest, you walk up the mountain of clouds, you get to the top, you navigate the anchor head, these weird little bubbles where like maybe a little bit of deep umbra has seeped in, causing the reality in that area to change. And you can arrive on Socta and talk to Phoebe, who doesn't want to do that. I also like the fact that the journey is symbolic, that the loons will never tell you not to go there, but they will try and dissuade you. Luna is busy. Now is a bad time. This is not how she wants to be visited. And the characters kind of have to persist. That feels like a very mage storytelling opportunity to me, that the trials are not those of combat, but those of endurance and knowing your purpose, and that the characters are just quizzed the entire time on the nature of it to make sure they know what they're really doing. And now we have this didactic combat to prove that you allowed to be here. Arcadian Gateway, I think, is interesting because the 1993 book came out 2 years before Changeling came out. So maybe in the initial cosmology, yep, this is where the fairies come from. And then later they're like, that's not the direction we want to go. So suddenly we had to like shift it. I like that it gives us the idea that it exists in the middle umbra because its primordial dreams slow the calcification and decay of the weaver and worm, and it is fundamentally different from the wild. So I like the idea that this is almost this artifact maybe of a previous cosmology based on denizens that Earth no longer has. I like the Werewolf 20 interpretation that this is kind of the bubble that was created when the fairies left Earth, when the fae left Earth and fled to Arcadia. What other weird zones could there be? Is there a deeper one tied to the Tuatha De Dane? Does the Khajiit of the Egyptian pantheon have something similar when they first fled? I think that's really interesting. I like that it shows that you have the four domains by season and how spring and summer are slowly losing to fall and winter. I like the fact that it would require an outsider to show that the shift has occurred and it literalizes it. The other thing is this allows you to play in the fairy sandbox without necessarily having to pick up Changeling, without necessarily having to pick up something entirely new. I like the idea that there are multiple versions of everything kind of running around out there, and each of them show you a different view. So Atrocity Realm, I think, is interesting because this is also kind of a place of healing. You only move past it once you have been destroyed. Like once your character has undergone a metaphorical death here, and the fact that you have the Great Library where you have to be either a victim or a perpetrator to be able to look through it is pretty fascinating to me. So when a character suddenly has access to this library, that raises a pretty fascinating question. Like, you want to tell us what happened there, Mark? No? Okay, I can understand. So, and the way this looks, like in previous edition, you have the Great Wall, which holds the master roles of it. I also like the fact that they give you the idea that the librarians that hold the archives are of those who actually died rather than metaphorically died. I like the idea that this is a rough place to heal, that this is where you overcome crimes. Like, the description of things are visceral, which I appreciate. It talks about how you leave a footprint that fills with blood and then maggots as you walk through the area, that scenes just continue and repeat and they don't stop. And that is frequently the nature of trauma. I wonder if there's the mage version of this where every colonization, every destruction of a paradigm takes place and is shown. The other thing it mentions is things never repeat enough to inure you to them. They are always changing enough so that they are always slightly shocking, but that this is also a place to investigate terrible crimes in the same way that you have a character that is used to walking into the sunless void of the underworld to investigate murders. What if another character is skilled at going to the atrocity realm to find the same thing? I think that is a really interesting avenue for a character. They have a magical item that allows them to easily go there, or they just happen to have some sort of incline to go there. I think that's really neat. And I want a version of the battleground where it is paradigmic and cultural combat, where it is worldviews that are coming up against each other, where you have the forces of the city of Pymander being opposed to an infinite army, seemingly, of Black Caps and Mirror Shades. I like that they present the Plain of the Apocalypse, which is the salt flat with no activity on it. Is this a place of peace, or is this a place of the final battle? And I think those are interesting. And like, what does it mean for a character to collect a handful of soil from the Plain of Apocalypse? Is that the most potent doom resonance that you've ever seen? What happens to a plant that grows in it? Weird places, interesting stuff. I like it. What are the rest of the realms, Adam?
Well, Dystopia is called the Cyber Realm by werewolves. This place is fascinating. It is a realm that manifests a cyberpunk future where a massive city gives opulence to a privileged few who dwell at the top of skyscrapers, comfort to those who dwell in the middle of those towers, misery to those at street level, and a nightmare to those underground. There are probably a number of realms like it in the High Umbra, so can we justify this one in the Middle Umbra? I say yes. Dystopia is Gaia's reaction to cities in the digital age. It has solid links to Earth that the High Umbra realms lack. Also, it is more stable and easier to reach than the High Umbra realms. Its link to the digital web makes it easier to work into your games. Its stability is probably what attracted the Technocracy to set up shop there. The three Umbra books never mention the Technocracy in Dystopia, which a little disappointing to me, but then I am a mage fan. The more detailed information on this realm in the first two Umbra books makes it easier for me to use it in my games. The cities of Earth either have links to this realm or create them occasionally. To better understand a city's spirit, a trip to Dystopia might help. A story about how the Technocracy starts a chain reaction they don't understand that affects Earth cities would let you take your players to all levels of Dystopia. The stasis spirits underground spinning out monstrosities sounds too good to ignore. Another difference with High Umbral Realms is Dystopia isn't about what people think. It is a place where the spirits of nature and the land try to understand and work out an arrangement with mankind's cities. Mages who visit can see how spirits of stone make peace with paved city blocks, or how spirits of the air adapt to pollution in the spaces between tall buildings. These spirits should not be obvious at first, but mages will notice them after a while. The werewolves think Dystopia is a realm connected to the Shenti of Stasis. If that's true, mages can travel through it to the Deep Umbra. Is there a portal in the nightmarish underground guarded by shambling cybernetic horrors, or perhaps an aircraft that lands occasionally on the roof of the tallest skyscraper to ferry the players to a massive sky fortress where a corridor leading straight up to the Shenti can be found? If you're taking your players to Dystopia, I recommend Augmented Reality by Paul Gallagher. The PDF on DriveThruRPG is quite cheap. Lots of roll tables to help you run scenes in Dystopia with minimal prep. The Radiance is a realm called Flux by werewolves. I think mages and werecreatures can agree it is linked to the Shenti of dynamism. The Radiance is another realm full of possibilities, but it can be hard on a storyteller. Swirling chaos may be interesting to consider, but how do you portray it to players at the table? Comic books like old issues of Doctor Strange or Sandman can give visual inspiration. As a storyteller, let your imagination run wild and drop wild descriptions on your players. If they get confused, that's actually what you want. After a short time, describe floating masses of stability that move through the confusing void. Players who move onto these will escape the worst of the instability. Even there, things change, and players may want to move to a better floating island. If your players make their willpower or wits plus enigma rolls, give them the hint that reacting to the environment isn't enough. They need to calm themselves and create a thought anchor. That means the area around them becomes stable and they can start to accomplish something. A possible danger is characters with different paradigms or points of view may become separated in different thought anchors. They could make arete or intelligence plus intuition or cosmology roles to keep together or find each other later. The Radiance seems to be more useful to mages than werewolves. The Umbra books describe werewolves using it to save time when making long trips. Mages can get rid of paradox, gain quintessence, and break bonds placed on them by addiction, magic, or insanity. Mages can even discover subtle magics influencing them or their talismans. Transformation magics are very easy here, but many effects can snowball out of control, so mages have to be careful. Travel to the Shenti of Dynamism is possible, but dangerous. The 2001 book adds a powerful Incarna spirit called the Coil. Mages could communicate with it, but the risk is high the coil will alter their bodies or minds. The 2014 book had a nice guide on page 64 for how many wits plus enigma rolls to accomplish things. The same book added a cocoon around the Realm of the Radiance that is like a massive labyrinth visitors have to solve before they can get to the Radiance. This makes a visit to the realm an accomplishment of its own. When the 2014 book describes the coil, it made it too vicious and too orderly at the same time. The 2001 write-up of the coil, I think, is the better one to use. I mentioned the mythic worlds already that werewolves call the legendary realm. I really like this realm and was hoping the Umbra books would give me more useful details. I was disappointed that the Umbra books describe a place so completely wrapped around werewolf culture that there's not a lot worth reporting. The 2001 and 2014 books changed the legendary realm from a fantastical place to a more, I would say, depressing place that is about to be torn up. Pangaea is a realm of prehistoric Earth when dinosaurs and other extinct animals roam. Nature is vibrant, dangerous, and strong here. I think this would make an excellent place for mages to visit. If it's Gaia's memories of her youth, that would be a good connection for your setting. Several eras of prehistory are merged together. Woolly mammoths are found near dinosaurs, for example. Mage fans will say, we've already got Hollow Earth. Who needs Pangaea? But I would disagree. I see Hollow Earth as a massive underground kingdom that includes many notions from early 20th century pulp fiction. Pangaea is a realm of dominant natural forces, no elements of human society later than Stone Age, and more accurate examples of Earth's past eras. Mages can find living samples of extinct plants and animals, another reason mage knowledge is superior to sleeper knowledge. You can take your players on epic wilderness survival stories here where they won't be rescued by anyone. The 2001 book added the Elder Serpent, which is a kind of massive dinosaur or dragon that seeks natural balance. Mages can learn about the Earth's past or the nature of the Middle Umbra from this creature. The Scar is an oppressive realm of darkened skies, industrial pollution, and overworked, abused laborers. Factories, rundown offices, and dirty tenements stretch out endlessly. It fits with the environmentalist themes in every edition of Werewolf, but I feel it doesn't fit quite so well with Mage. Werewolves go there to fight pollution so that specific places on Earth will be easier to clean up. You might take your players there to teach lessons about the dangers of industrialization, but I'm not planning to use it in my games. There are some rules in the 1993 book about getting trapped and breaking out. You could repurpose for a prison realm somewhere in the Umbra. The last near realm is Summer Country. The Umbra books state this realm is only for werecreatures, but again, I disagree. This realm is Gaia's notion of peace and balance, a dream of paradise. Here, mages can see how Gaia wanted plants and animals to turn out. Animals, people, and werewolves live here, but they are peaceful and welcoming. The books focus on this being a place you take your players only once, and it's a very emotional experience. I would tone down the emotion and use it as many times as I want. There are several beautiful spots to visit that I would enjoy showing my players. The books state those who visit forget everything when they leave, but I would change that. I would use it as a place to rest and recuperate during a difficult journey through the Middle Umbra. The danger should be getting too comfortable. Humans are not only creatures of nature, but also mind and will. Settling into comfort and inactivity should present the danger of discovering much time has been lost. Mages will forget what they were doing or other important things. Leaving the realm is the only way to restore the lost memories. So, Terry, what are your thoughts on these last of the six near realms?
Dystopia is, and the cyber realm is kind of interesting. I like the way you brought up the fact that this is Gaia dealing with cities. It's modernity. It's how do we see these places run into it. The description in the 2014 book is like, this is the place of the feeling of future shock. of being displaced. And I think mages are going to have an interesting relationship with that, especially because they're frequently embodying ideas, paradigms, and worldviews that are notionally being bypassed. I'm kind of curious to see the characters, the syndicate member, the hyper-technologist who looks at this and goes, yeah, this is the way things should be. This is my summer home. And you're like, oh, okay, we just learned something about you. I think the idea of the micro and macro realms in the computer web are pretty fascinating. The idea that high above this multi-level city, there is this vast computer network, kind of gives another version, seemingly, of the digital web, but in the middle umbra, again, because everything has to be everywhere. We have the flux. Again, I like the idea of the coil and the cocoon to tamp down how OP it is to go to the Radiance if you're a mage. Where it's like, wait, I get all my quintessence back, I can burn off Paradox, and I'm no longer addicted to cigarettes. Why? Why am I not? Like, I think there was one particular edition where there was a threat of exploding or something if you spent too much time there. But still, I like the idea, though, that it is both, that there is this web you have to navigate to get in. And once you do, there is still that threat there. And that this giant entity, the coil, is kind of this intelligent manifestation of chaos that will kind of trap you in these mirror-like zones to mess with you after a certain time. And this brings about kind of one of my favorite tropes in science fiction, probably best shown in Stanislaw Lem's Solaris. In the book Solaris, where it's, if you're going crazy and you think you're going crazy, how could you prove to yourself that you're going crazy? If you're trapped by the coil and you're worried that you're trapped by the coil, how would a mage work out if they were being trapped by the coil? And I think that is an interesting question of perception and being. The legendary realm, Adam got it right. This is werewolf. Like, is there a mage version, though, where every great archmaster is there, where Tsar Vargo is still out there, where Wingard's March is still happening, where Tezgul the Insane is still there, where Duizetep is still earthly? I think that could be interesting. The problem is we don't have enough information about any of those places to really talk about it. And I don't know that mages necessarily talk to each other in the same way, but I like the idea that every archmaster to have ever existed or every exemplar is kind of has a domain there. Or people think it is the place of the oracles, but it's clearly not. That it is spirits of the idea of ascension and kind of no more. Pangaea as this time before the rise of the gauntlet, I think is interesting. I'm not really sure what to do with it. I do like the giant snake creature that may represent the worm when it was still at balance. But I could also see that as a place of investigation that your etherite botanist is super interested in doing, going with it, consequences be darned. Or your naturalistic character being like, obviously this is home, and you're like, you are attacked by a pterodactyl. And you're like, yeah, didn't have pterodactyls on the bingo card today. The scar, I like the scar, especially in its relationship to Cyber Realm. This to me is very much listed as a place where your goal is to go and do monkey wrenching, where it is a place that is so dangerous and so on a powder keg that the spirits in charge of it are always trying to get more productivity to answer to their board, and that your character's goal is to go there and to cause a factory to explode or something like that. And I think that's kind of a neat way, especially if you want to have a game where your characters get to be destructive, but don't have to literally blow up a building. like there's always that superhero problem where it's like, oh, wow, you stopped the rampaging monster. Who's going to do the cleanup? And Mage, to me, in games frequently has that difficulty. The Scar, you could go there, you could blow up something, you get a metaphysical victory. Great, you just kind of get to move on from there. I also like how they talk about the hierarchy of Bane's spiders just kind of wandering around, acting as consultants, getting their many hands dirty, how the barons have left for Cyber Realm. I think it's kind of an interesting place. And then Cyber Country, I do like the idea that you could get to go here once, just once, and that every mage kind of has to pick when that happens. Or alternatively, this is used as a one-on-one storyteller session. Maybe it is a type of seeking, and you get one, and it resolves something, and everyone has their own memories of it, and it's maybe something that mages don't necessarily talk about, where it's just this kind of deeply personal experience. There are some realms that we don't get, that we don't talk about really, because they're too mage-specific. I'm curious to see how we could make them more mage-specific, like Erebus. Like, what is the realm of atonement for a mage? Is this a place to work out permanent paradox or a derangement or quiet or hubris? is this a kind of a place that mages are sent to, and kind of like a combination seeking harrowing that the realm is used to cast judgment, where it's like, hey, you've done this mage crime. We are not going to judge you, but we are going to send you to Mage Erebus, and the realm will determine what is appropriate for you. Is it paradigm specific? Does a Nefandus that goes there get through scot-free because to them they didn't do anything wrong? Like, what do with that? And kind of my final one is, what is the notion of Wolfholm, the place where you go on lupus form and you're kind of stuck as a wolf in human guise without access to your human form? Like, what if this is a place where mages go back to the first city, when magic was the only weapon that really allowed them to rise up against vampires, and they have to stage that again, where mages were new and didn't have that power? Maybe it represents the human experience during the Impergium, where werewolves were just killing humans because they thought it was the bad thing, and suddenly it is still a werewolf-themed realm, but you need to defend it against these dark primal aspects. Maybe this is where delirium comes from. Maybe you can only take the form of some weird spirit or bygone, and you have to try and exist in the modern world. You go there and you become a unicorn, and one of your friends is suddenly a griffin, and you're like, how do we make this work? I think there are interesting ideas that it's certainly more of a lift, but if you have an interesting idea on how you would reskin one of these, send us an email, throw it in the Discord. We'd be fascinated to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, zones don't fit neatly into the layers of the Near Umbra. They even extend into the Deep Umbra. The digital web is a zone. Werewolves don't actually know about it. At least they don't talk about it in the books. Even if they stumble into it, they will probably believe they are still in the cyber realm or that realm's computer web. This would probably give mages an advantage when dealing with those werewolves. The temporal zone is mentioned in passing in the 1993 book. The 2001 book tells us the temporal zone recreates places from Earth's past. It allows your players to effectively time travel without actually traveling in time. The 2014 book and mage books don't mention the temporal zone. I gotta admit, I don't have interest in the temporal zone, so I'm really okay with ignoring it, but you know, I've got my own biases. The dream zone is mentioned in all three books. Changeling books and Mage's second edition claim the minds of dreamers go to the dream zone to have their dreams. The first two Umbra books state people create a chimera in the penumbra, which links to the dream zone. The dream happens inside the chimera, which is in the penumbra, but gets energy from the dream zone. The 2014 book states a chimera is a realm that forms when many people have the same kind of dream. There is a chimera for dreams of falling, dreams of running from a threat, etc. When a person has a dream that matches a chimera, their mind goes there. If their dream is unique, they don't go to a chimera. World of Darkness books sometimes have inconsistencies. Storytellers have to resolve these for their own games. I would resolve this one by saying werewolves aren't always right. The chimera is a portal to the dream zone where the dream is happening. I think werewolves visiting their own dreamland is fine, but entering the dreams of other people, I gotta say, I think this is venturing too far away from the themes of Werewolf the Apocalypse. Also, they mention other spirits and things going on in the dreams, but give so little information that I wonder what they were trying to accomplish with that. So, Terry, do you have any thoughts on zones?
Yeah, I'm perfectly fine in a game where all of these exist, like where the Chimera, the Dream Zone, the Maya, the Dreaming all exist. Sure, why not? They don't need to contradict each other if you don't want them to, although it does create a kind of cluttered umbra. And as Adam said, you have to pick, what are my themes going to be? Do I want this to exist? Do I want it to be rare or common? I like the Temporal Zone. Boom, we get to play Sorcerer's Crusade. Boom, we get to play Victorian Mage. There's a sideline in the 2014 thing that's like, why does this exist? So you get to play Werewolf the Wild West. And I'm like, pew, pew. And just pull out my finger guns and run with that. So I do like the idea that there are alternate ways to get to these places. But yeah, Mage generally covers these as a much richer place. As a note, in Mage, pretty well the only case where we talk about the dream realms extensively is Book of Worlds, where we have the Etheric Sea, and then we have the different dream types. The thing that I wish it gave us more is we don't get a lot of information on why we would want to use these, in my opinion. Werewolf is usually pretty good at saying, hey, these are places and this is why you would want to go to them. Not a lot of information on what would necessarily draw people there. Wish there were a little bit more on that, but kind of my only criticism on those.
Well, subrealms are something I don't remember reading of in mage books. These three Umbra books define a subrealm as a realm that is a kind of shadow cast on the near Umbra by a zone or large realm in the deep Umbra. The Shenti of Stasis, Entropy, and Dynamism create subrealms. The books don't say it, but the computer web of the cyber realm may be a subrealm of the digital web. They don't get detailed examples of subrealms, but the idea fascinates me. A subrealm could link to the zone or realm it depends on. Clever mages could use them for easier travel to distant places. Those who know what the subrealm is linked to will have an advantage while there. Putting mysterious realms in your games that turn out to be subrealms will reward players that have dots in cosmology or take the time to solve the mystery. If the players work out what concept or realm the subrealm is tied to and then lead adversaries there to exploit the advantage, I would let them get away with that as long as they don't try it too often. Subrealms appear in both the high and middle Umbra, but I would put realms linked to the Shenti only in the middle Umbra. I think the forces of dynamism, stasis, and entropy act more powerfully on the world than they do on individuals. So, Terry, anything to share on subrealms before we wrap up?
Yeah, I like that there are two directions to take this. One would be in Mage. Subrealms would be a sign in the spirit wilds that you're near a realm. That there's a subrealm of the atrocity realm of terrible abuse of a village burning down or something that is the sign that you are there and you have to do some sort of mission action or whatever as kind of a way to get into a realm first. The other thing is, I do like the idea that there are areas where these triadic forces directly bleed in and kind of create their own inflected areas. And this is something that we can take into the high Umbra outside the fortress of government is the fortress of oppression where stasis or something is leaking through or something similar that can happen where any of these other forces, cosmic forces, are like running into a well-established area. They're fine. They're flavorful. It answers the question in Werewolf, if there is no spirit wilds, what is between the realms? And this kind of lets you have that as a slightly more complicated and slightly richer cosmology. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review of Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in their searches. You can follow us on Twitter @MageThePodcast. We're also on the web at MageThePodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes. We have a YouTube channel now where you can find our episodes. There's a link in the show notes, but you can just search for Mage the Podcast on YouTube and you'll probably find us. We're also on Mastodon. The link is in the show notes. This episode was assisted greatly by our executive producers. Terry, can you share the names of our executive producers?
I was thinking at first that we would cheat and we would use our outro twice. But the thing that makes an episode is the fact that one of us reads this whole damn list. So you're right. We have to go through it and I will. if they're going to give us $500 a month, we're reading their names twice. I would like to say thank you to our executive producers, who include Oracle Ben Bendelow, Oracle Buck Gregory, Oracle Christopher Phillips, Oracle Guy Stewart, Oracle Jay Widener, Oracle Josh Hillerup, Oracle McHale, Oracle Pukaji, Oracle Sean Gallagher, Oracle the Crew of Erebus, Oracle St. UX Player, Oracle Sorcerer Sanguine, as well as Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archdemaster Derek Svensek, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Michael Parker, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Archmaster Wolf Lyerson, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Andrew Zass, Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Fragerock, George Laura, Friedrich Owl, Henry Kraft, Eobold, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jake Gatsby, Jeff Bren, Jenna F., Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Jolan Andes, Lalzenstuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Lizzie Weatherstone, Manel Canos, Matthew Prohl, Michael Creedle, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ruben Joseph, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Sev Nessus, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Thank you so much for your support.
If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help keep us producing episodes. You would also become part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The links in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
And if you're going to make a change to the Umbra, just do it. We're not going to stop you. There's so much. It just keeps going. Bye.